Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Paratransit Service conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would like to now introduce your host for today's conference, Mr. Peter Berg of Great Lakes ADA and Accessible IT Center. Mr. Berg, you may begin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to ADA Distance Learning 2003. Today's session is being currently captioned on the Great Lakes ADA and Accessible IT Center at www.adagreatlakes.org. The service is being provided today by Caption Colorado. The live text streaming that is being used is accessible to individuals using assistive technology such as screen readers. I would like to encourage you to contact your regional disability and business technical assistance centers. The 10 regional centers are co-sponsoring the distance learning series. You can contact your regional center to find out about upcoming distance learning sessions, including the December 10th session on planning temporary events and the January 21st, 2003 distance learning session with Sharon Rennert from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. You can contact your regional center at 1-800-949-4232. Today's session deals with paratransit services and looking at the question, are paratransit services equivalent to the services that are available to non-disabled individuals? Today we are very pleased to have with us Marilyn Golden from the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. Good afternoon, Marilyn.
Good afternoon.
Marilyn will take us through her presentation. You can find her presentation again, on the Great Lakes website, www.adagreatlakes.org, there are several links that will take you directly to the portion of the outline dealing specifically with the paratransit portion of her presentation. Additionally, there are other resources available on the Great Lakes site, and there is also a printable copy of the presentation, which has been added to the Great Lakes site. Marilyn is a policy analyst with the Disability Rights and Education Defense Fund. She has been closely involved with the ADA from its from the writing of the legislation to the implementation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. She is a highly regarded trainer for the Disability Rights and Education and Defense Fund, and she is the author of the ADA and Implementation Guide, which DREDF uses in its trainings. Marilyn was named to the Access Board in 1996, the U.S. Access Board, by the President. And she is highly regarded with her knowledge and expertise on transportation matters as they relate to the ADA. With that, I will turn the session over now to Marilyn.
Peter, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be on this teleconference with all of you today about the paratransit requirements of the ADA and the advocacy we can do to improve them. You can find a DREDF transportation outline on the web at the Great Lakes DIBTAC. I will follow along on the paratransit section. At the beginning of the outline, you'll see that it's DREDF's training outline for transportation. You can use this outline if you maintain the DREDF byline at the top, the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, and also you'll see that, and also, of course, if you don't make any changes in it, right near the top, the Great Lakes website has put a link right to the beginning of the section on paratransit so it's easy for you to find it. It's section 6, starting at the bottom of page 3, if you printed it out in the very small type. It's not exactly my presentation, but it is our training outline, which I will follow more or less. And while you're finding that, let me just mention that if you're interested in ADA transportation, I have been asked by the Southwest DIPTAC to do a few other things in the next few months that people should know about. One exciting thing is the Southwest DIPTAC is sponsoring to everyone, not just in their region, a 3-day training in March, March 18th to 20th in Albuquerque, New Mexico. There will be some spaces for people outside of the Southwest region. And also two more events on transportation, something like today's call, although webcasts. They'll be January 29th and February 12th, also on transportation, free. And to find out either more about the training or the webcast, you can call them at 713-520-0232 and ask for Maria. Let me repeat that number, 713-520-0232. Ask for Maria. And feel free to ask for that data again during the question session if you didn't get it. I will say some things about advocacy techniques as I go through, but I'd like to do even more of that during questions, so I certainly encourage you to ask. To transition into the specific paratransit requirements, I want to remind everyone, which many of you know, that the ADA covers things besides transportation. The Americans with Disabilities Act also covers employment and public accommodations, which is a fancy name for most kinds of public places, also the activities of state and local government, and also telecommunications. And the areas, spheres of life that we have not talked about, that things like what happens in the classroom, K-12, things like housing, are covered by other disability rights laws. Within the ADA, the section on transportation, actually it's a couple of sections, cover both publicly funded transit, which is what we're talking about today, a part of it. It also covers privately funded transit. Things like Greyhound buses or taxis, to some degree, are covered by the ADA. Transportation, again, as many of you know, are divided into categories, into many categories. The two biggest categories, besides public and private, which cross-cut those two, are the areas, the categories of fixed route and demand response transportation. Fixed route transportation means a system of transit vehicles that come and go according to a fixed schedule, whether or not you do something to summon the vehicle. The bus, the subway are examples. Demand response transportation, by contrast, are where the vehicle comes to you only if you hail the taxi or register or call the paratransit van. As I move into paratransit, I just want to mention that it is something of a challenge today to cover all of it. I will certainly do my best to run through the highlights. There will be important information we don't get to, but I'll certainly do my best, and at the training in March, we'll cover everything from top to bottom. Okay, focusing in on the section of the outline called paratransit as required is perhaps most important, the general rule, which states that it's discrimination under the ADA and Section 504 of the Rehab Act for a transit agency that operates a fixed route system, a fixed route bus or rail system, to fail to ensure that paratransit is provided to people with disabilities who cannot use the fixed route system, who cannot use it. The ADA doesn't pretend to provide all the paratransit we need. It's an equal rights law. It provides paratransit to the same extent as everyone else uses the fixed route system to people with disabilities who, due to their disability, cannot use the fixed route system. And in order to implement this concept of people who cannot use the fixed route system, the ADA sets up three categories of eligibility that if you fit within one or more of them, you are eligible for paratransit under the ADA. The ADA recognizes then that there always will be some people who are unable to navigate the fixed route system on their own. And so these three eligibility categories have, in a way, nicknames, which you can see in your paratransit outline under eligibility. Category one, can't navigate the system. It includes anyone with a disability who is unable as the result of their disability, with or without someone else's assistance, to board, ride, or disembark from a vehicle on the system that is accessible. So they can't ride even if the vehicle is accessible. This category would include, for example, people with cognitive disabilities if there's someone who would not know where to get off the bus or how to get to their destination from the bus stop. It would also include, for example, a visually impaired person, a blind person who has no mobility training for a particular destination. It would include a person with multiple chemical sensitivities who may not be able to tolerate a particular element that's on the bus but could tolerate the paratransit vehicle. The second category needs an accessible bus is someone who, due to a mobility impairment, needs an accessible bus, but the buses are not lift or ramped equipped, are not yet accessible on the routes they are riding. This, of course, this category has less and less people in it as things move forward in time and as bus systems replace old buses with new accessible buses, which most cities in the U.S. have now done. The third eligibility category is dubbed specific impairment-related condition. And it includes anybody with a disability who has whose disability prevents them from traveling to the boarding location or from the disembarking location to where they're going. It includes issues like architectural barriers that are not under the control of the transit agency, or environmental barriers, distance, terrain, or weather. These things do not in and of themselves form the basis for eligibility, but the interaction between them and a person's disability can form the basis for paratransit eligibility. And this brings in the concept that you can be eligible for some rides or not others. Somebody may under this category be always eligible, for example, again, if there's significant architectural barriers on the way to the bus stop for a person who uses a wheelchair. Or it could be weather-related. Someone who uses a wheelchair may be able to negotiate the way to the bus stop just fine on a summer day up a gradual hill, but cannot do it during the dead of winter with 2 feet of unplowed snow on the ground. And in that situation, their impairment-related condition is interacting with the environmental barriers of the hill and the snow to trigger eligibility. I want to add that a few thoughts on eligibility, which, like many things with paratransit, has proven to be an area with lots of pitfalls and lots of challenges. Many transit agencies have found a lot of factors that have broadened these categories. For example, a visually impaired person may have mobility training to reach a destination, but will encounter architectural barriers if there's safety hazards on the route. A wheelchair user who often takes the bus may still have conditional eligibility based on environmental barriers, like we mentioned, and also architectural barriers, and also limitations to how accessible the fixed route system is. There's not a system in the country that wouldn't have some of these barriers. There's also a concept in eligibility that if something is so difficult as to be tantamount to impossible, it is not reasonable to expect the individual to do it. Further, it's been argued persuasively to me that if the paratransit corridors, and we'll talk about service area in a minute, but if the paratransit corridors are 3/4 of a mile and the wheelchair user can't go that far, they are eligible. In transit planning, non-disabled people are not expected to walk very far to a bus stop. So people with disabilities should not be either. Another important thing to remember about eligibility, perhaps the most important, and to train people with disabilities as they go to eligibility evaluations, is that a lot of times people will only mention their primary disability and not secondary disabilities or secondary situations that come from their disability, such as disorientation. Or somebody may mention the icy weather, so they're determined, or they may be determined to be eligible only when the bus has no lift, but there are other architectural issues or other environmental issues. So it's really important to train people to be very thorough in mentioning the different kinds of barriers that they genuinely encounter in order to make sure they get a fair shake when eligibility is evaluated. Let me move on past eligibility to something that I categorize with eligibility and is on our outline near eligibility, which is the issue of an associate riding with someone. The ADA recognizes that people don't travel alone, and the issue was, should people traveling with you be able to ride paratransit, given that it might be a trade-off with space for someone else? And where the ADA regulations came down is that at a minimum, you can always have one associate ride with you. If you're going out with a friend, with a family member, with a date, that person should be able to go with you. If you need an attendant in order to travel, that attendant does not count against your one associate limit because that person is needed due to your disability. And so you still can ride with another associate. The transit agencies are encouraged, they're not required to, accommodate additional associates. Now I want to move into the area called paratransit service criteria, which really answers the question of how good does service have to be? And a lot of the issues, virtually all the issues that we all struggle with our paratransit systems come up here. It's small c in your outline. If you printed it out, at least for me, it came on page 4 in the middle. Paratransit service criteria. There are 6, and the first one is service area. And you'll see another illustration of the literalness of the ADA's civil rights mandate here, in that the ADA gives people with disabilities exactly what non-disabled people get when riding the bus or train. I'm going to focus on the bus, and if people want to talk about paratransit for subways or light rail, please bring it up in the question answer. The service area, when the paratransit is supplementing a fixed route bus system, is only required to be corridors that mirror the fixed routes. This is a little bit easier to illustrate visually, but we don't have that option today, so I will do my best to explain it, and your outline explains it in a lot of detail. Some people are surprised by these requirements and just assume that the paratransit service area is the whole city covered by the fixed route system. But actually, cities are allowed to really limit it to the corridors that the buses run on. These corridors have to be 3/4 of a mile on each side of the fixed route, that is, each side of the street. So that's 1.5 miles wide total. And at the end point of each route, it's like a semicircle around the end point, three-quarter of a mile radius. Within the central urban area where all the corridors cross each other because the routes converge, the service area includes all the areas crisscrossed by the fixed routes. and service has to be provided from any point in any corridor to any point in any other corridor. Service criteria number two is response time. It's been a controversial one lately. Many of you may have seen Dredf Action Alert in August about the issue of next day service, which was resolved well, and there was a victory alert on that a week or two ago, and that's something else we can talk about during question and answer if it's of interest. But the response time provision is quite strong. It requires transit agencies to schedule and provide paratransit service to anybody eligible for it at any requested time on a day in response to a request made the previous day. That's the previous day at any time. So if you want to ride at 10 in the morning on Wednesday, you can call for that ride at 5 minutes of 5 on Tuesday. The reservation service has to be available during all normal business hours of the transit agency, and those same hours even when the agency is closed, for example on a Sunday, if that's the day before a service day. So they can't require you to request your rides on Friday for the Monday. They have to take your reservations the day before. An important rule that can be hard on people with disabilities is that the transit agency is allowed to negotiate pickup times with the individual, but cannot require you to schedule a trip more than an hour before or after your desired departure time. If they can't accommodate you within that one-hour frame, that is a denial of a ride, and they should be counting it that way. And I want to talk about that a little bit more under the sixth capacity constraint, the service criteria capacity constraint.
Excuse me one second, Marilyn. Could I ask you just to speak a little more directly into your phone?
Sure.
Thank you.
Didn't know that was happening. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay,
thanks.
Good. The third service criteria is about fares. Paratransit fares are allowed to be twice the fixed route fare. Not a discounted fare, but a full fare for the trip of any similar length at a similar time of day on the fixed route service. Fares for somebody accompanying a paratransit eligible individual must be the same as for the person themselves. Though if you need an attendant in order to travel, they will not be charged. The fourth service criteria, no trip purpose restrictions. Usually this doesn't come up. It came up a lot before the ADA, where transit agencies might take you to the doctor or to work, but not to school or not shopping. And since the ADA, transit agencies are not allowed to prioritize you based on trip purpose. Peter, is that coming through okay?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. The fifth capacity constraint is hours and days of service. And it basically states that paratransit has to be available throughout the same hours and days as the transit agency's fixed route service. Now, that does not mean that the hours will be the same system-wide. If some bus routes run, say, from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m., paratransit can run on those routes and end at 5 p.m. But other routes may run through 10 p.m., and the service on those corridors for paratransit has to run then until 10 p.m. The last service criterion is capacity constraints, and this is very much the one that causes us the most grief. It basically states, a little abstract, I'm going to try to make it a little more concrete, is that the transit agency is not allowed to limit the availability of service to people who are eligible in any way, really. And, for example, by not restricting the number of trips you can take a week or a month, by not establishing waiting lists, and by not establishing any operational patterns or practices that significantly limit paratransit availability, including things like substantial numbers of significantly untimely pickups, that is, late pickups, substantial numbers of trip denials or missed trips, that is, where they deny you a trip or where they schedule a trip but simply do not pick you up, nor substantial numbers of trips with excessive lengths. Those are the capacity constraints stated in the ADA regulations, although others are important as well. Substantial numbers of late arrivals, substantial numbers of arrivals way too early, having to wait on hold to arrange a ride for the dispatcher for excessive lengths of time over and over and over again. Another capacity constraint would be particular unusual policies that they may establish. For example, there was a transit agency which for a long time had a rule that required people to reconfirm their ride 2 hours ahead on their return trip, on their outbound and on their return, which was very difficult at times, depending on what people were doing. If they were taking an exam, if they were having a medical procedure, you obviously can't make a phone call 2 hours ahead, so could add 2 hours to your day. It was very difficult, and difficult to change, too. So those are good examples of capacity constraints. A very important principle that has come into paratransit enforcement is that capacity constraints such as denials count as illegal if the reason for the denial is something that was within the transit agency's control. So this principle basically means that if, say, the tornadoes our country experienced a few weeks ago caused you not to get your ride, or if there's a big power outage that affects the ability to receive a phone call by the transit agency, the phones are out, so you can't reserve your rides, something unexpected and unable to be planned for like that, rides that are denied or capacity constraints that occur are not to be seen as violations of the ADA. But if the reason for the denials is the fact that the transit agency doesn't have enough vehicles, doesn't have enough drivers, doesn't have enough dispatchers, doesn't have enough phone lines, because of their failure to plan for the expected amount of demand of paratransit, that's a good example of something that is within the transit agency's control. Those denials are basically considered violations of the ADA. I want to point out that there's another option for providing service that changes this situation just a little bit, and that is subscription service. Subscription service is when someone's going to the same place, say, 5 days a week, such as school or work. It is easier for them not to call in every day, but just to arrange for the paratransit agency to pick them up and take them home the same time every day. It's also good for the transit agency. It saves money. It's easier for planning. However, the ADA does not permit transit agencies to let subscription service consume more than 50% of their vehicle capacity at any period of the day. That means that if more than half the people riding at that time want subscription service, the transit agency may be required to limit it. And if that's the case, there may be a waiting list for subscription service, not for service at all, but for subscription service, where people may have to wait to get it, or even discussion of what purpose is your trip. Because transit agencies are not allowed to give subscription service to everyone, The reason for this is so that there will be paratransit capacity left over for occasional and spontaneous riders. A few other important things on the issue of these capacity constraints. A big area of difficulty is paratransit pickup times. There's a lot of things that really can skew the pickup times and the arrival times, causing either late pickups or late arrivals to a degree and to a rate that has a significant, terrible impact on the life of the rider. There's the one-hour window. Then there's the pickup window. A lot of transit agencies will establish, if you, say, expect to be picked up at 8, their policy is that you can pick up anywhere between a quarter of 8 to 8:15, and you have to be ready. So that adds some time. And that window varies from city to city. There's other problems, because the time that you understand to be your pickup time may be different from what is written on the driver's manifest. So we're really always urging advocates to have transit agencies be sure that the ride time they negotiate is on the manifest of the driver. There's other things that make this very difficult. And so when you add them all together, we have people who need to be at work at 9 who are calling for rides, say, at 6:30 in the morning. And then on the occasions where they're picked up promptly, they may get there at 7:30 in terrible winter with no weather shelter, and the building doesn't open till 10 of 9. So there's been a lot of problems with this. And one hint that we are giving transit agencies, and it's unfortunate that this isn't in the regulations, but it's good if they use arrival time. For example, the would-be rider will say, I want to be there at 9. Forget when they want to get picked up. The issue is when they want to arrive. I want to be at the doctor. I want to be at work at 9 or at 10 or at 8. And then the transit agency can plan more easily around arrival time. So that's worked a little better when we can get them to do that. A good standard for them to set for themselves is that we can get you there a half hour early, but not late at all. That's probably a legitimate window given the inevitable slips to some extent that occur in paratransit. We also encourage them to establish daily tours. That is, a tour is what the driver's list of who they're picking up and who they're dropping off and where. Those should be redone every day and leave them with the driver. This is something that can be advocated for. Sometimes the transit agencies will fit a few more in there, but they have to be actually thought about. Another big thing that is failing to happen in a lot of cities is for the transit agencies to really monitor pickup times and other aspects of paratransit performance. Transit agencies often rely on paper monitoring, the reports of their contractors, rather than actually going out and spot checking at known destinations and riding the pickup and the drop-off times. It's important not just to rely on the contractor reports. That is not real monitoring. Now, many systems are monitoring their fixed route service very actively. Does the driver get there on time? It's very common practice for them to do this and then not to do it on paratransit. And there is a move to talk about just one transit system, meaning that paratransit is a full part of the system and is monitored as closely and taken as seriously. So that's a few things on the issue of pickup times. On the issue of paratransit denials, again, I come back to this concept. What constitutes, we said in when I gave the denials rule that significant numbers of denials are a violation. Well, what constitutes significant numbers? The answer we have now from the Federal Transit Administration, from all of DOT, is that transit agencies cannot plan to serve less than 100% of capacity. Things beyond the transit agency's control will sometimes cause denials or missed trips, the power outage affecting phone service, the very significant freeway accident. But if a planning decision, such as vehicle purchase or hiring drivers, or failing to do those things, affects you being denied because the planning was not done, that's the concept governing which denials are illegal. I also want to point out, just go another couple minutes here, and then I really want to take your questions. I don't have to be the one to tell you that the denial rates in some cities are having a very significant impact on riders. And some of you may be, as advocates, may be in the situation where the transit agency is saying, oh, but we have only a 3% denial rate, or 2%, or 4%, or some very small thing. And one would think that this would then mean that a 3% denial rate must mean that a paratransit rider who calls, out of 100 calls, 97, they're not denied, and 3, they are. That is what it sounds like, and we know in the experience of our clients or ourselves that, in fact, the denial rate might be much higher. For every 10 times we call, 10 times we call, we may only get 5 rides or 6 rides. Sometimes these denial rates are very, very high. How can they be talking about 3% and 5%? Well, sometimes it's, in fact, not an accurate counting. But sometimes it is a good faith counting. There are a lot of things in the whole system of paratransit that skews those numbers, and that is why the discrepancy is there. I'll give you just a couple of examples. Let's say you wanted to ride at 2, and they say they can't get you till 3:30, and you accept the ride. That's more than an hour different than your desire. If they don't record that as a denial, that will skew their statistics. Another big thing is if they average in subscription service. Subscription service naturally has fewer denials. If they average all service together, that will lower the denial rate for people who ride intermittently. Also, denial rates are often quite a bit higher if you call the day before you want to go than if you call a week before you want to go, assuming your transit agency accepts week in advance. There may be a 2% denial rate calling 5 days in advance, and a 60% denial rate calling the day before. But if the transit agency averages the denial rate over everybody, that will really lower that number and, in a sense, make it look like a smaller denial rate. And, of course, there's all the people that are not calling because they've been discouraged. There's all the people that couldn't get through to the dispatcher if you're in a city with long hold times. So there's a lot of things that savvy advocates really need to be aware of when hearing numbers from the transit agencies. I want to say one other thing about these systems, which has to do with contractors. We've had a lot of questions about how contractors should be organized. It's not a great idea when multiple contractors serve the whole service area because the contractors will try to take the cheap and easy subscription trips and push the other rides off on the other contractor. This particularly has happened if one is nonprofit and the other is for-profit. It works better in a larger city if they each have zones, and it works better still in a small place to just have one contractor. The other factor that I like to mention to advocates, it kind of gives a different perspective on these issues, is that a conclusion that many of us have come to in working with these agencies is the huge discrepancy that almost always exists between the pay for regular bus drivers, fixed route bus drivers, and paratransit drivers, who are usually paid much lower than bus drivers. And we hypothesized that if that problem was resolved, if the pay was the same, it would overnight resolve a huge number of problems we have on paratransit. We're doing well. Let me just take maybe another few minutes and just talk a little bit about the administrative procedures in determining eligibility. And then I want to open it up for your questions. The ADA does not lay out a method for paratransit eligibility determinations, and there's a huge variation. Sometimes it's the medical form and the doctor and your signature. Other times there's in-person evaluations. Sometimes everybody is always eligible, and other cities do conditional eligibility, trip-by-trip eligibility. But regardless of what system they use, all information has to be accessible in accessible formats. There can be no fees for determining eligibility. They are allowed to functionally evaluate or test you. They are allowed to give you broader eligibility, though they are also allowed to limit it to the categories I talked about. They're supposed to give you documentation of eligibility that states clearly whether or not you're eligible, and if it's conditional, then on what basis. And an important fact is that there's a 21-day limit on the procedures for eligibility determination. After you submit an application or finish the application procedure, whatever they are, if they have not made an eligibility determination within 21 days, the ADA regulations say that you are eligible and can ride. So that is the incentive for them to be prompt. And they may require recertification of eligibility at reasonable intervals, such as every year, every 3 years. And this is actually increasing in more cities for eligibility to be redetermined. A big area that was a problem before the ADA, and in some cities still, is the issue of visitors. Can visitors use paratransit? And the ADA absolutely says yes and sets up procedures for it. A visitor is someone simply who does not live there. If a visitor has documentation that they're eligible in their home city, they can show it and they are eligible, period. If they do not have that because they do not ride it at home or because they come from somewhere that does not have it, such as a place without fixed route transit that is not required to provide paratransit, the transit agency is not allowed to go through a whole 3-week procedure. The person wanting paratransit, the transit agency may require them to present proof of residence and some documentation of their disability unless it is obvious, if it's not apparent. And then they must provide transportation service. That can happen for up to 3 weeks. If a person is going to be somewhere longer than that, then they should apply for residential eligibility. So after a 3-week stay, the paratransit service can require a regular eligibility determination because they have a 3-week limit themselves on how long it takes to process it. Two other important things. One, the appeals process. The transit agency is allowed to establish, must establish an administrative appeals process for people who are denied eligibility to obtain a review of the denial. The transit agency may require that appeals be filed within 60 days of the denial. The appeals process must include an opportunity to be heard and to present information and arguments. The decision must be made by someone uninvolved with the initial decision to deny eligibility, and written notification must be provided of the result with the reasons stated. The transit agency does not have to provide service to the individual during the appeal. But if the transit agency has not made a decision on the appeal within 30 days of the completion of the appeal process, then service must be again provided to that person. The last important point I want to explain is the issue of suspension for a pattern of missing scheduled trips. Just as the transit agency is under regulation, not to have an undue number of missed trips. The transit agency can suspend individuals for routinely not showing up for trips. Sometimes this suspension issue has been abused, and other times not, and it can be abused both ways, of course. But the transit agency is allowed to establish an administrative process to suspend for a reasonable amount of time the provision of paratransit to people who establish a pattern of missing scheduled trips or no-shows. Trips missed by the individual for reasons beyond their control, including but not limited to the transit agency's fault, cannot establish a basis for this. So if transit agencies sometimes hold no-shows against someone when it was a trip that they missed outside of their control, that's not legitimate under the ADA. Before a suspension, the transit agency has to notify the individual in writing with specificity the basis of the suspension, in other words, why, setting forth how long it will be. The individual can appeal using the same appeals procedure I just explained a few minutes ago for eligibility. And you are not suspended through the appeal process. If your appeal upheld your suspension, then you can be suspended. Transit agencies have introduced a lot of kind of aberrant policies in with the suspension, and it's been really important to look at what the suspension policies are and kind of clean them up and limit them to just what the ADA allows.
Marilyn, in that same area, we have received some phone calls from transit agencies as to whether they can charge individuals for missed rides or perhaps even a pattern of missed rides.
Well, that's an interesting question. I would have to say no. The fare is for if you ride. The transit agency has something else they can do if you miss a ride, and that is the suspension for a pattern of missing scheduled trips. I think that charging, in Dreda's opinion, that would not be legal under the ADA. I do not know what DOT would say, and I have not heard of them addressing it, but I do not think that would be legit. It's a good question, though, and Peter, it's a good transition time. Let me just say things that I was not able to get to in case people want to ask about them. For one thing, I'm certainly happy to list other ideas for advocacy techniques that we've seen effective if somebody asks. Some people may be interested in how some cities are trying to establish premium service, paratransit service that goes further than these minimums I've described, but charging people a higher fare. So that's something happening in a lot of cities. The trends in eligibility lately with various cities is another thing we could talk about. There's a commuter bus exception to paratransit. Issues raised by door-to-door and curb-to-curb service is another thing. So
excellent.
Those are good topics, and I'm sure you'll have lots more.
Right. Well, let's bring in Lorraine at this point, and she will give instructions on how individuals can ask questions. We please ask that individuals limit it to one question so we can let as many people ask questions as possible. And once you do ask your question, we will drop your line so that we don't have any feedback. So, Lorraine, if you could please give instructions.
Thank you. If you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Thank you. One moment. We have questions coming here.
Okay. Marilyn, just quickly while the questions are lining up there, if you could speak briefly about the Department of Transportation and the amicus brief that was filed briefly, a copy of which is available with the other resources on the Great Lakes website.
Good question. This had to do with next day service. There's been a very important case in the Second Circuit in New York, a paratransit case, one of the issues in it being next day service and a huge number of denials. And the disability side saying that every individual gets next day service and the transit agency arguing that the capacity constraints provision means that what is illegal is not missing a single individual or a small number of individuals, but only significant numbers of denials are a violation. It was kind of a controversy over the next day service criterion and the capacity constraint service criterion. It's a bit involved, and I can talk more about it if people like. The upshot, though, was very good. The brief submitted to the Second Circuit by the Solicitor General for the Department of Transportation did firmly establish the next day service right and say that, denials outside the transit agency's control are a violation, that transit agencies have to plan to serve 100% of expected demand.
Excellent. Lorraine, do we have a question available? Lorraine, if I could just briefly ask, after the first question is asked, if you could check to see if our Caption Colorado is still with us. We've seemed to have lost the captioning on the Great Lakes website, so if you could check on that for me.
I sure will. Okay, our first question comes from Martha White.
Hi, we have two questions at this site.
Hi, I have a question. I'd like to know, is there any independent entity that is monitoring the turn down from the transit agencies?
So is there,
you want to say the other one now?
Okay, we're still recording it, but...
Okay, that's fine. There is no established independent entity monitoring. It's a great thing to try to get your transit agency to do. And frequently, when lawsuits are filed and the settlements are negotiated, independent monitoring is part of the settlement. And it's, of course, critical to really seeing what happens. Another thing that's like that transit agencies can do and if there's a lot of problems should do is there are some very, very good transportation planners and consultants that can be hired to evaluate a transit agency's paratransit service and their fixed route as well and find what the problems are. Now, I'm sure there's some not good transit planners and consultants that can be hired as well. But we're aware of a few that are very, very solid and turn out reports that really lay it on the line of where the problems are in great detail with the transit agency's operations at a level that, you know, a lot of us advocates just would not understand the operations well enough to be able to do. And these reports are very useful tools. The Federal Transit Administration is doing these reports on transit agencies gradually across the country based largely on where complaints come from and other situations that bring to light the need to do them. But transit agencies can do them on their own as well.
Excellent. Do we have our next question, Lorraine?
Yes. Captain Colorado is still on with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The next question comes from Myra Burloff.
Hello. Thank you for this conference. My question is on eligibility. Are regional transit authorities allowed to ask an applicant who's applying for paratransit services the diagnosis of the applicant?
Are they allowed to ask who?
The diagnosis of the applicant.
Who are they?
Of the Regional Transit Authority, we have one in Massachusetts that is asking applicants for paratransit not why they need to use the paratransit service, but their diagnosis of what their condition is.
That's a good question. I have not seen it specifically forbidden, but it is true that these are supposed to be functional evaluations. And your question also, in a sense, takes into account that there are many other areas under the ADA where asking questions about disabilities is illegal. I think you could make an argument that it is. That it is illegal.
It is.
And that it should be functional. I would want to look at this question a little more closely, though, before I stated a black and white answer, yes, no. Where I am with it at this moment is, I think you can make an argument that it's legal, and you could also, you could make a good argument that it's illegal, but you could also make an argument that it's nowhere explicitly forbidden. If you want to contact Dreda, email me through our website at www.dredif.org. I would be happy to look more closely with you at that question.
Great. Thank you.
Excellent. Lorraine, our next question, please.
Next question comes from Linda Henry.
Hi. This is Linda Henry. I'm calling from Billings, Montana. And my question has to do primarily with the procedures in determining eligibility. You discussed the requirement, I guess, of 21 days to complete this determination. I have a young woman who has made application. She has been eligible in the past for medical pickup and delivery for medical purposes, appointments, and is trying to get through the winter weather, pick up and drop off for an extracurricular activity. She's a high school student. And when does the 21 days begin and end? And if the transit agency is asking for additional documentation, is that all wrapped into the 21 days?
Well, first of all, if she's eligible for medical appointments, she should be eligible, period.
We agree.
So I already hear a violation not of the eligibility determination process, but of service criteria number 4, no trip purpose restrictions. Eligibility is eligibility.
Right.
It's important also to remember that the paratransit we're talking about is paratransit provided pursuant to a fixed route system.
Right.
There's a variety of services out there that aren't necessarily subject to these rules because they're not provided pursuant to a fixed route system. But if they are, if it's ADA paratransit, they should be eligibility is eligibility, and it's not for this or that. It's only subscription service where they really are allowed to ask any. It is not there, as my nephews and niece say, it is none of their beeswax where you are going. I mean, they shouldn't even ask.
Yes.
And so that's already a problem. Eligibility is eligibility, and I encourage you to take action, some kind of, file a complaint on them. But if someone is applying for eligibility, meaning they're not eligible now, once they submit their, it depends on what the transit agency's eligibility procedure is. Once they submit their application, if they've not, this is the basic rule, if they submit their application, it's not resolved in 21 days, then they're eligible. Now, I don't know if your system has applications. Maybe they have in-person evaluations. If they do, then it's 21 days from that. If they have applications but then they're seeking more information from you, I guess one argument would be you've submitted an application, so it's 21 days from that. Another argument would be they ask you for more information, and the more information constitutes the submitting of the final application. So, the procedures vary so that it's a little bit hard to say definitively. But does that help at all?
It helps a whole lot because our point has been if they'll pick her up for medical appointments, wherever else she wants or needs to go is, as you said, none of their business. Why shouldn't she be able to go Christmas shopping just because it's cold out and she can't go to the regular bus stop and wait?
Right, right. Excellent. Thank you for your question.
You.
Lorraine, do we have another question?
Yes, from Nathan White.
Yes. Our public transportation system in Portland, Oregon, for the paratransit is looking at eligibility changes and mainly going to the functional approach. And we want to know, are there any requirements and how important it is for the community to be involved in the design? We're concerned that the transit service is going to make their own decisions without getting input from the community at the design stage.
That's a great question. At the early years of ADA paratransit, in 1992 and approximately 97, there was a lot of requirements for community participation. Subsequently, transit agencies have been given permission by DOT to not have to submit these more elaborate paratransit plans, but to really just self-certify every year that they're not in violation. And they've been making changes without the community participation. But the ADA actually does require community participation for major changes. And your outline, look for public participation in development of plan. One could argue that these community participation methods are required when they make major changes. And I would encourage you to make those arguments. It's gotten a little ishy-squishy, though. Is it literally illegal for them to change these procedures without community participation? I'm not comfortable saying 100% yes, it is. But it's a good argument, because you have a good argument to make, because it is in the DOT regulation, and you can find them. You can find these in your transit outline a little bit lower. Also, I should just mention another resource that Dredf offers that is available to you that goes into much more depth than our outline. Dredf's training manual on the ADA, which is called the ADA and Implementation Guide, is available for sale. It is an extensive book. It's very well organized with lots of subsections, very thorough, and it includes all the information from the statute, the regulations, the technical assistance manuals, and even the legislative history leading up to the ADA. It is purchasable from Dredf in alternate formats, of course, if needed. It's $100, $75 for people with disabilities or disability organizations, which is a rate that probably everybody on this call would apply for.
Great.
We have one more question.
Go ahead.
Yeah. If a transit agency like ours is providing greater than the minimum requirement paratransit, which I think is curb-to-curb, and they're providing door-to-door service, is that considered a premium service, and can they charge a premium fare for that?
Okay, thanks for the question. We're going to go ahead and drop your line so we can go ahead and let Marilyn answer that question.
Okay. Transit agencies are increasingly establishing premium services and charging higher fares. What they mean is not that they move everyone to a higher fare, but that they provide basic ADA service that at least they say meets the minimums I've talked about. And then additional to that, they offer service that is better in one or more ways, but is more expensive. They're allowed to do that. But if you don't want to do that, you can always do the base, say you can get basic ADA fare, ADA service for the same fare. They're not allowed to only give you better service. In other words, say we do door-to-door, we're charging more to everyone. They have to provide the basic ADA service with the fare in the ADA regulation.
Okay.
And also an additional service. I want to make sure if that answered.
Sure. With regards to that, what are the obligations of the transit agency in terms of getting the individual into or out of the building? Does that get into the premium services that
Well, it actually gets into the questioner statement, which was correct, by the way, that it is true that transit agencies are allowed to choose whether they're going to provide door-to-door service or just curb-to-curb, meaning that the individual has to come out and
mm-hmm.
Come to the vehicle. If they choose to provide door-to-door, that's great. If they don't, they don't, and they're allowed to establish it. So they are only required to take you if you get out to the vehicle. There have been a lot of problems with door-to-door. Some transit agencies still do it. Some offer it as a premium.
Right.
But I would be very disturbed to hear if they offered it only and required a premium. That certainly would not be legal under the ADA. There has to be an ADA service that is the fare we described
and
no more than that.
And if they choose to provide the premium, that's the individual's choice to use
that
or not.
That is the individual's choice. That's right.
Right.
That is the individual's choice to pay it and to take that service, and then it is the transit agency's is free to charge more for it.
Excellent. Lorraine, do we have another question?
Yes. Jerry Reeder.
Yes, my question is, did I understand you correctly to say that the transit systems have to provide next day service? Ours requires that you call 2 weeks ahead of time.
Requires 2 weeks ahead?
Yes.
Where is that, if I may ask?
Pardon?
May I ask where that is?
That's Northern Kentucky, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Well, that's certainly illegal. If it's ADA transit, if it's ADA paratransit provided pursuant to a fixed route system, and I can explain what I mean by that if it's not clear, then they have to provide next day service. That is a very serious ADA violation.
Well, they say that they can't do it the next day, that you have to call 2 weeks ahead of 2 weeks in advance. So, you know, I'm glad to know this information because one of the transit authority people are on our board. So, you know, I'll give them this information.
Good. Go get them.
Excellent. Lorraine?
Mindy Demarest?
Yes, I have two questions. The first one is, why when I go from my house to Penn State College, my fare is only $4, and when I come into another place, it's $6, and the other place is closer?
Well, I guess that it gets to the issue of Maryland of how many times a rider on the regular fixed bus route would, you know, if they would be required to transfer and any additional charges that the transit agency can charge a paratransit user.
Yes, that certainly can be the reason, exactly as Peter said. If the same trip on the bus would cost more, then your paratransit trip is allowed to cost more. Now, we say that we don't know that that's the case here. So people should look closely. Maybe it isn't the case, in which case it's not legal. But it would be legal if it costs more on the bus, with the same proportion, remembering that they're allowed to charge twice the fixed route fare.
So do they charge by mileage?
No, they charge based on how much it would cost to ride the bus to make the same trip.
Same trip. Excellent. Thank you, Mindy. Do we have another question, Lorraine?
Yes, from Christy Mattel.
Yes, my question is concerning premium services. I'm wondering if you could describe or give us some examples of what those are and how some of the paratransit systems across the country have gone about establishing or developing those.
So yes.
I have another question also.
Okay. Well, do you want to say what it is now?
Oh, the other question is, you mentioned excessive length in terms of the ride could be a violation. What's considered an excessive length of time to be on a bus?
Good question. Okay. In terms of premium service, looking through some notes because I have some good examples. For example, it may be things like if your service area is limited to corridors, but the corridor is mirroring the bus routes, but the transit agency decides to make a premium service that goes everywhere all over town. And another one would be making the service be door-to-door and not just curb-to-curb. Another one might be subscription service beyond immediate subscription service, not going through a waiting list. Another one might be, let's see what some other people are doing. Oh, some cities are using same day. It's called real-time scheduling. If you think of how taxis in a big city, how taxis are routed and dispatched, people don't call for a taxi the day before. Well, sometimes you can, but you don't have to. You call an hour before, half hour, whatever, and you can often get them more quickly than that. And that's because a dispatcher is continually dispatching those vehicles. Paratransit is allowed to use that same system, and for years Los Angeles has. They are thinking of shifting away. But that's called real-time scheduling, and it means you can get a ride quicker. My understanding is that the accessible taxis in San Francisco, you can ride that way, even if it's as a paratransit ride. So there's some San Francisco is doing some good stuff with real-time. Some cities, for example, Chicago, is intending at least, I'm not sure this has been implemented, they announced intentions to offer as part of their premium service, same day, real time, so you could call the day you want to go. Another aspect of premium service can be wider eligibility. Let's say you could take a fixed route service, you wish to take paratransit, you would not be eligible for ADA service, but if you'll pay the premium fare, they'll give you eligibility for the premium service.
Excellent. In Maryland, getting to the caller's second question regarding the time that a trip takes and what would be considered to be extended.
This is an area that we're just beginning to move into a little more closely. Before recently, there has not been a lot of rules of thumb, but some material is starting to emerge. I would have to kind of pull some things together. If you want to email me at Dredif, which is www.dredif.org, go to that website and email me. I'd be happy to share that material with you.
Excellent.
I do not have it assembled at my fingertips.
And if
but I should add that if where you live, the rides are always hugely longer than fixed route. You know, it would take a half hour on the bus, and all the paratransit rides are 2 hours long, or most of them. You know, that's too much, and that's a capacity constraint. But how to make it, how to cut it more finely, I'd have to pull some things together for you.
Okay. And if individuals want to, they can also email the Great Lakes Center through the Great Lakes website, and we will forward any of those questions onto Marilyn. Lorraine, do we have another question?
Yes, from Janet Cha.
Yeah, for a person who has MCS and can't ride the regular buses, what options are available? Because traditionally it's the other passengers or conditions in the bus before they get into the bus that's the issue. Is there ever any option for private pay or mileage for people with MCS? And you know, especially if they have other disabilities as well.
In city, I mean, I think that there's nothing in the ADA regulation that really requires it. And it puts people with the MCS at a disadvantage, which is,
yeah,
you know, the same disadvantage that they are always in, where things are much harder, and the ADA did not do a good job in sort of anticipating the more finely tuned needs. It's something that we all are working on, and I work on, and we all have to work on, because I'm tired of always having to tell, you know, this constituency, we have to come up with things that are outside what the ADA provides. I would say that in cities where the transit agency is acting in good faith to try to do a good job, and those cities do exist, I would encourage people with MCS to come together and approach the transit agency with the kind of problems and suggestions that you've talked about. I think I know cities that would try to accommodate you, but I can't say that they're required to. And I think that one problem inherent in the system that I don't know what to do with is that yes, sometimes it's the previous passengers, but other times it really is the vinyls and solvents and upholstery and other things simply used on the paratransit vehicle. So people are as people have as much difficulty riding paratransit as they would the bus.
Excellent. Lorraine, do we have another question?
Yes, from Chris Glover.
Yes.
Chris?
Who is responsible for the costs incurred for certification?
Definitely the transit agency. You mean for eligibility determinations?
Right, or recertification, when you have to go to a doctor or whatever to get certification.
Oh, I see. So you're saying the doctor charges even, say, to fill out a form?
Sure. Mm. That's time. Time's money.
I would make an argument that the transit agency is required to cover it. I haven't seen anything on it, but it is a cost, and there aren't supposed to be any charges.
That's what I thought.
So I would, you know, I think that would be a really good area to make a complaint to the FTA on.
Okay. Thank you.
To make that argument. In Maryland, for individuals who are for transit companies that require certification initially, are they responsible to provide transportation, for instance, if they have an on-site evaluation? Are they required to provide transportation to that evaluation?
Yes, they're required to provide you transportation to that. Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
And there's been some interesting innovations, for example, in Los Angeles. They're coming to the individual with a vehicle that has, all the eligibility determination equipment and what have you in it. So they're actually coming to individuals. But generally, yeah, if there's a functional evaluation, usually it's at a central location, and they have to give you paratransit to get there.
To get there. Okay. Excellent. Lorraine, our next question, please.
From Kim Stewart.
Yes, my question is, what's been your experience with regard to transporting persons with morbid obesity who, with their combined weight with their power wheelchair, is in excess of 700 pounds? I've run into that situation recently and have been working with transit to try to resolve it, but it hasn't been very frugal so far.
Yeah, I'm not optimistic because there are weight limits in the U.S. Access Board's requirements for what lifts or other accessibility devices such as the ramps into vehicles have to be able to sustain. And if it's over that limit, which my memory tells me is 600 pounds.
Correct.
If it's over that limit, they don't have to. And people, for example, in Salt Lake City have been challenging this. I think there's a lawsuit over it, in fact, and I don't know that it's been, actually, I think it was decided and was appealed, but people are not having luck because the weight limit is clear in those standards, and it's not good. Again, I would say that in places where there is good faith, approaching the transit agency for some of the vehicles to be able to sustain a higher load, but it's an important need and a legitimate one, but I don't know how to say that I can't give you a legal basis for arguing that they are required to go over those limits.
And that's a question that the DIP techs see frequently, especially with the proliferation of power assisted devices and scooters, which enable individuals who in the past couldn't get around now can, but then they run into the problem of not having transportation available to them.
This is a good example of the need for these standards to be periodically revised. I serve on the U.S. Access Board, and it goes without saying that, although also deserves to be said, that as some mobility devices get larger, there needs to be changes in the standards. Also, as people use scooters more. And it's been very, very difficult politically to attain higher standards once a particular accessibility standard is in, say, the ADA accessibility guidelines. The guideline in question on the weight limit is also a standard from the Access Board for vehicles. And I want to talk to people and staff about changing it, but it's very difficult to do it, but important to try to do it. And the disability community, as advocates, we have to keep pushing on it.
Right. Lorraine, let's try to get in one more question before we wrap up the session here.
Okay, the next is from Debbie Jackson.
Yes, hi, Kirby Shaw from her office. In regard to trip denials, if the paratransit agency does not report anything more than zero trip denials, is that and it's known that in fact there are denials, what can be done about that? Is there an obligation on the part of the agency to report denials?
No, but what can be done on any of these things if they're violated is largely the same. In addition to advocacy, you can use the enforcement methodologies in the ADA, and there's two avenues, and I should talk about that briefly before our session ends. The two ways to enforce this part of the ADA, and in fact any part of the ADA generally speaking, is submitting an administrative complaint, which can just mean writing a letter or filling out a form. That goes to the Federal Transit Administration, or litigation, filing a lawsuit. Both of these have had success, and we encourage people to do it. I know that the DBTAC has forms for people for submitting ADA complaints. Peter, and I would assume you also have the address for FTA.
Yes.
And I encourage people, Peter, I don't know if the DBTAC even can send all the sites the form and the address.
Can do what? I'm sorry.
Can send all the sites for this conference call the complaint form. If people want to file a paratransit complaint, just to email as an attachment, and also the address of FTA so people can file these complaints if they want to.
Put that information, absolutely.
Put it on the website or even send it by email to the sites.
Absolutely.
That'd be great.
Excellent.
That information can also be obtained from DREDF. So again, if people want to email me through the DREDF website, feel free to do that.
Excellent. Even with our expanded time for the new ADA distance learning series, we still have a line of questions that we're not going to be able to answer. I would encourage you to contact your regional disability and business technical assistance centers for any additional questions you may have. I'm going to throw it back to Marilyn to give us a recap before we end the session.
I don't have anything specific to say other than we really encourage people to keep up the struggle. It is extremely important to advocate for better transportation, and it's, generally speaking, the only thing that has worked is to hang in there and push at the transit agency, work with people, organize, and push for better service. It can be effective. People should make use of the ADA's enforcement procedures, filing complaints, filing litigation. This may be the area where litigation has been the most effective on transportation. And you're always welcome to contact me at DREDF if we can help further in any way. Contact us at www.dredf.org.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Marilyn, for an outstanding presentation today. Again, for additional questions, I would encourage you to contact your regional disability technical assistance center at 1-800-949-4232. You can contact them about upcoming distance learning events, including the December 10th event, Creating Access to Temporary Events. Please notice that session is being held on the second Tuesday of the month and not in the normal third Tuesday of the month slot, and that is due to the holiday schedule. So I know that it's the middle of December, and perhaps planning temporary events may not come readily to mind, but this is when counties and municipalities are making plans for next summer. So this is a very important event to tune into. And then in January, on January 21st, please join us for our first Ask the Expert, when we will have Sharon Rennett, the Senior Attorney Advisor with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, answering questions from you. Again, I would like to thank all of you for joining us today. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time. Have a great day.